Welcome to Content Disrupted, bold takes on brand marketing. I'm your host, Casey Noble, and together we'll explore what it takes to excel in brand marketing at one of the most exciting and disruptive times in industry history. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Content Disrupted, bold takes on brand marketing. Joining us today is Tricia Nichols, an absolute powerhouse when it comes to marketing innovation. She's steered the marketing strategies behind brands like Gap, Estee Lauder, Pepsi, and most recently as CMO of Belk until last year. Currently, she's advising brands and she wears many other hats as a speaker, angel investor, board advisor, and member of the Women in Retail Leadership Circle. So today we're going to be talking about brand bonding in the modern digital landscape. And welcome to the show, Tricia. We're so excited to get started.
Thanks for having me. Super fun. All right. Thank you.
Awesome. So you have had kind of a dream career in marketing, working for the brands that you've worked for and the roles that you've held. Before we dive in, I would love if you could just share with listeners a little background about how you first got into marketing and what led you into your current role.
Of course. So I actually started agency side. And I have to say, I recommend that for folks who don't know which path they want to take. Agency side, you really learn to wear multiple hats, you hustle, and you get a lot of just rigor in your career. So I started agency side in media. I think that was a good starting launch point, and worked agency side until I was working eventually on the Pepsi account and then joined Pepsi. But during my time at the agency, I was in media, but started to really migrate into positioning the brands and storytelling and what insights are behind that. And at one point, our agency had an incubator agency and we launched brands like Match.com. And that was, I'd say, an amazing experience before you walk in and join on the brand side. So highly recommended to start there. And then, as I said, I ran Pepsi Media for a long time, agency side, and then went on to join Pepsi themselves, work for them at their headquarters in New York. And from there, migrated to Gap and Estee Lauder, and then a company that is private equity. It was a pet retailer, sort of like Whole Foods for pets. Really fun, interesting brand. I was CMO there for 4 years. And then most recently, you mentioned Belk.
Awesome. So when we talk about the role of marketing, given the range of your experience, and you're obviously familiar with all these different sort of goals and objectives that we put in front of marketing, we hear a lot about building brand awareness. Our focus is lead generation or building customer advocacy. But you've been known to use the term brand bonding as sort of like a mission and mantra for marketing. So I would love if you can share a little bit about brand bonding. What does that actually mean to you? And why do you think that's an important sort of concept for us to center ourselves around today?
Yes. Okay, great. So I'll give you the definition, but even before that, why I might have gravitated there was actually being at the agency side, but being close to CMOs and trying to solve for what they're solving for. I learned early to ask, what would the CEO say is the challenge? What is the challenge bigger than marketing? What is the real challenge? Is it customers not returning? Is it customers not understanding a value prop? It may be product has lost its way and marketing's trying to solve for that until product gets back on track. There's so many different challenges that maybe aren't happening at the even marketing only conversation that you need to take a step back. But I found that brand bonding is a bit of, it solves for more of a longer term need. Brand bonding by definition is multiple frequent positive engagements with the brand, one that consumers will seek out, not just experience, but they're actually beginning to, I want to open that email. I want to see what they're up to. I need to go visit their website and see what they're up to. They tell others about it, not just from an advocacy, but they're like, you've got to download this app. You've got to look how I interact with this brand. I love them so much. And you need to do this too in your life. That's bonding. But what you have to do as a marketer is brand bonding and brand love are very close in sentiment, but brand bonding is measurable. It's actionable. So multiple positive frequent engagements with the brand. There's a company called Brand Z that I learned the quantitative side of that from, and Brand Z format. And if you're sitting at the CEO, CFO table as a marketer and you're with your peers and ultimately the accountability of the company, you've got to have something that is quantifiable. And brand bonding is quantifiable. And what if you introduce decision science, data science, you can really start to unlock what caused people to bond to you. What does their behavior look like when they're bonded? You begin to define it in your own terms. Brand bonding means they opened this many emails, or brand bonding means they attended this event or answered the survey, or they came to our store 7 times, even when that's not their normal range to come. And now we've increased that range. So there's a lot you can do to lay out a scorecard, if you will, on brand bonding, and customer health is really what it is. But that bonding is that when you've reached that moment where you've met maybe share of wallet commitments that you think would exist, but now you've exceeded. They're coming more often than you would have expected them to. And now they are your best customer, your ideal customer. And you can begin to try to migrate toward that bonding. So it's fascinating. And, you know, I learned it along the way from Gap and then took it into Essay and Independent Pet Partners and just kept going with it. So I'm fascinated. But today I think it is fueled by a really great decision science team, data science team, customer health kind of dashboard.
Yeah, I want to get into the data science aspect of this, definitely. First, sort of like higher level question that I have. We talk a lot here about sort of the fragmentation of the digital landscape. So with the expansion of digital channels, we've got people splitting their time between a lot more platforms online. It's becoming harder and harder to sort of be able to count on reaching our audiences in any one place, like much less capture their attention for an extended period of time. How do you think we need to adapt our marketing strategies to reach and create those sort of bonding experiences with audiences, given those sort of challenges having to do with like that digital fragmentation that's happened in the marketing environment?
Yeah, the fragmentation is on one side. And then there's now, unfortunately, we're going cookie-less. So even the ability to find that audience or to quantify and attribute that audience is tougher. I do think if you take brand bonding as a whole journey, it is multiple positive frequent engagements, which means that the fragmentation of digital landscape and the paid media landscape is actually working in your favor. Because if you're really looking at what's driving people to bond with you, it's going to be a combination of, it's a concert. It's a whole journey. It's not one thing that they did, but you met them on their journey, maybe from an education standpoint. They're coming to maybe Estee Lauder. They don't know a lot about skincare. You've actually educated them on something and you're not just selling them a product, but now you've told them why you need this, why you need a serum, why you need this regimen. So there's a currency there. So I think that the fragmentation allows you maybe to build this sequential storytelling that lands in sort of repetitive journey, but you're hitting on multiple different things. And eventually you're going to figure out what triggered them to actually stick. And that's when it becomes fun because you can say, it's not the old segmentation of, oh, these are value seekers and these people are looking for this. It's, wow, they really bonded on this educational point and this is what they wanted to learn from us. Now I think that opens the door for other conversations we can have. So the fragmentation, a challenge when it comes to if you're trying to tie one point of attribution to each individual and you're not looking at the sum of the parts, or you are looking at some of the parts and you're not looking at the whole picture. But when you really break it down to, I need multiple points of interaction, I need multiple points of frequency that open up new doorways, the landscape can be a help, but you've got to have a really good, solid understanding and modernize your marketing attribution models. You've got to think about not just what did they do last week and what happened last week, but what is the future probability that XYZ will happen based on this concert that I've created? And what part of the concert is weaker and what part of the concert is stronger? So I think it can be an enabler. It doesn't have to be a hindrance. But I think the cookie-less part of it is going to be the challenge of how you move into the new world with Google and topics and how you move into leaning more on first-party data or zero-party data, but thinking about maybe your own internal teams and how you can structure to have some scientists some really help in your tech stack to build into that audiences that you're trying to build. But I think it's going to be some sophistication on the data side, certainly. But I think the fragmentation is great if you land the intent of your channel. Are you looking for TikTok to do the same thing you're looking for Facebook to do? Absolutely not. No. If you are, you're in trouble. If you're comparing those two to each other, you're probably in trouble. You need to lay out the intent. TikTok has got a certain behavior and Facebook has a certain behavior and they have tails, longer and shorter tails from each other. So the marketer's got to understand that. And then that all boats rise, right? When you're kind of putting it together as a concert and saying, all right, now we're going to really bond because we're going to figure out what's cooking, what's happening, but what got them to that point of bonding.
Yeah. And from the storytelling aspect of this and sort of a content planning aspect, this sounds a lot like sort of it dovetails with the micro storytelling strategy that you brought into brands like Estee Lauder that sort of just transformed the way they were marketing and kind of put them at the forefront of especially leveraging like social media marketing and things like that. So can you share a little bit about like micro storytelling? And I'm curious the way you're talking about structuring your narratives, even though you're doing how you're planning content for different platforms and what people are looking for on that platform, but maintaining consistency in terms of your brand narrative overall. How do you approach that structure?
In my time at Estee, that is where I'd say really began to formulate the terminology micro storytelling. It was because brands can do a macro story. They often will have one main story and it lives within the customer value proposition. It's very smart. They know what the value prop is. And so they land a macro story. That doesn't always answer all needs for all customers, especially when you're looking to resonate with maybe younger customers or different customers than you've had, or a need to re-energize the brand because the product is re-energized. So micro storytelling allows you to sort of break it down. So Estee is a really great example. If you were to say, hey, people will love us because of this one thing or this one part of our value prop, but you're missing out on all the people that might have stumbled to the brand because they were looking for, what's the right regimen I should have at night for my skincare? What time of day should I take off my makeup and apply skincare? What matters in this? What should I be buying? And if you can open that doorway, so micro storytelling began as a way of saying, okay, we want the macro story. That's great because there's the credibility of the brand. There's the heritage of the brand, especially a brand like Estee that has a deep founder story and great scientists, great program in terms of how they are bringing products to life and what's behind that. But for certain customers, they may need the ingredient story. They may need the regimen story. They may want to know why a serum and what order do I apply that in? They may want to know how it came to be, right? Like Estee Lauder happened to study sleep for years and that's how they created Advanced Night Serum. Those doorways are micro stories. Those are telling smaller stories at a level that you can then say, now we've reached them multiple times with multiple stories. We're going to find the one that they really resonated with, the one that probably got them to convert. But essentially, you built a broader story with them. Maybe you actually touched on more points of the value prop than you could normally do in a one-shot kind of asset storytelling. And I think the other really interesting thing to that is that fragmentation of the digital landscape, you can build a sequential storytelling. Say the first time they interact with us, we want them to see the credibility of the brand and the maybe something more inspirational. The second time, we're going to really tap into the how to. Third time, the why to. The fourth time, how to get it, where, when, why, and really convert them. And that becomes a really great playbook. Micro storytelling helps you get there. And that work, it means working really closely with the creative team to lean into that sort of thinking.
I love that. So you're taking sort of the value prop and it sounds like breaking it into, okay, what are those, how, why questions that, so it's like making sure you're answering the right questions for the right stage and then thinking about the channels that you're operating in. And from creative standpoint, how do you tell that how story or answer that why question in a different way on a different platform potentially? Awesome. I love it. I want to get into the data science that you were mentioning. One thing I love is that you've been known as a CMO who spearheads digital innovation, transformation. A lot of the times you're sort of like get brands there first, which is really exciting. And one thing I love is it seems like you, instead of like passing off that sort of role in the decision-making when something like data science to an agency or a consultant, you seem to dive in and get to know that discipline firsthand so that you can better help steer the organization. So as someone who is kind of like been hands-on with data science and really understanding what that's all about, can you describe how you see being it applied first and foremost, just at a high level? Like, what is data science to you? How should we be thinking about applying it as brands?
Yeah, it is a favorite topic over the past few years. I've really found so much benefit in this world. So first, yes, it's easy to outsource that kind of thing. Easy to let that sit at an agency, especially easy to let things like marketing attribution sit at an agency. But what I learned about digital science along the way, and I actually learned from one of the best, his name is Nick Zhentek. He was at Independent Pet Partners, now at Bell. I had brought him over. He taught me one really important thing, which is what decision do you want to make with this data? What are you trying to do? Don't just request the data. Don't just ask questions about customer health. What are you trying to solve for? And that muscle, building that muscle for a marketer to say, data for data's sake, yes, you could look at a million miles of things and get truly overwhelmed and actually have your digital media and your CRM and everything else kind of going in a million. Talk about fragmentation. You could actually fragment yourself to death. But if you want to build a really strong, maybe personalization strategy or a really strong You know, where do we put the first dollar or the next dollar? That role of what decision are you trying to make is critical. And it circles back to what I said earlier. Say, what is the CEO trying to solve for? Because marketing may be able to reach up higher than just the customer awareness and customer this, but the health of the company, is the value prop correct? And is it living across the company in the right way? So I have found that having that in-house is invaluable. It can be built elsewhere. I also learned, again, from the best thing, Genentech, but also a company called Penfield. We've tapped into quite a few times to get to a really great place of prescriptive data and predictive data to answer questions like, before someone's churning, before they leave you, what does that behavior look like? So you can grab them before they go. But then what's that thing that will get them bonded and keep them back in? So it's just this customer health dashboard, if you will. And I think that dashboard is best held in-house. Not everyone can do it. Not every company is going to invest. But as a marketer now, like my right arm, I love it. I learn from it. And it's even good if they don't report to you. It's great if they do. But the fact that there's an unbiased sitting there within the data scientists, they're not going to be afraid to say, hey, that thing you did didn't work. And you've got to be bold enough to say, thank you for letting me know. And now I need to do something else for the company. It's not just my personal dashboard and scorecard. It's, is the company healthy? So I love it. I think it keeps you accountable. I think it keeps you learning, and you can experiment and test and learn with customers and really start to drive your business for the positive.
Awesome. And you mentioned previously that importance of data attribution and being able to set up the proper attribution to be able to feed into something like a dashboard like you're talking about and make more data-driven decisions. So I'm sure you have entangled some hairy data attribution issues in your time. What have you found are some of like the biggest challenges, the biggest takeaways or best practices that you've learned from your experience when it comes to attribution and approaching that?
Actually, probably the biggest thing I've learned in the most recent is sometimes attribution, you need to change what you're looking at or how you're defining success by the audience viewing it. The marketer will want to know what happened last week, but the marketer also really wants to know what will happen next, or they should want to know. For instance, you could say, hey, we may take product X out of the system. And so the marketer is like, oh, okay. But if the data team is asked, we may take product X out of the system. Let's see what that, based on sales in the past, what kind of impact would that have? If a marketer is sitting on top of a data science team and knows that the data science team can do some prediction work, we can say, hey, why don't we see what sales would be lost in the future if we remove product X, or if we'd make a change to our support of product X? You don't have to just remove the product, but maybe marketing has deprioritized that. But we say, well, before we deprioritize it, what would the future of that product look like if we model that out? So the reason I give that example is not really a marketing attribution example, but it's the difference that can be made if you are understanding your audience and who's asking what and why. Marketing attribution at the CEO and CFO level, they may actually just be interested in short-term sales. What's driving sales today and what will drive sales next week? Where the marketer has to weigh not only the future potential of the plan that I have in place right now, but what are channels doing? Like for those of us back in 2014 that were saying, I think video commerce is going to be a thing. I think video commerce is coming. I think shoppable video will be something that will happen. I was building a model, a gap that was saying, let's tell the model to look favorably at that channel, even though if it just viewed the past, it would say, don't put a lot of money here. It's too little. But we said, override that thinking and tell the model, hey, I want you to think positively about that channel because that's where things are headed. And I need to start laying the groundwork now for next year's budget, which I'm playing with. So I think there's something really interesting in who's asking the question and how you may weigh in the future potential of a channel or the future potential of a customer acquisition impact on your business to whomever's asking. The marketer should want to know all of it. Sometimes the CFO may only want to know last week, last year, last quarter. And you just got to know how to work through that so that you're protecting the future of your company as well as just making sure you're productive every day that goes by.
And you mentioned the operational aspect of this a little bit already. So when you're setting up that kind of team and making data science really a part of the ongoing way that the company thinks about decision making, plans ahead, you are a proponent of having that expertise in-house. So let's say you've got your data scientist or a data science team, depending on the size of your brand, maybe. And then ideally, that rolls up into marketing. But how are members of the marketing team and members of, say, a data science team collaborating together? What does that frequency look like? What does that team model look like, in your opinion?
Yeah, ideally, I've done it both ways, where the data science team reported in, or I've created that customer health team mindset within the company, and I've had it where it was reporting into this CFO. Again, I don't want them to feel biased. I don't want them to feel like they can't be honest with the marketing team about what's working and what isn't, or that it's just a conflict of interest in any way. So I'm actually happy for them not to report in. I'm happy for them to report in because I like the mentoring and I like the access, but I'm happy either way. However, that said, it shouldn't change the interactivity between the marketing team and the data science team, because normally your data science team is paired, right? So there's some that may be paired to support marketing, maybe CRM more deeply, maybe some are on paid media more deeply, personalization. And then you may have some team members in data science that are supporting supply chain and supporting the store teams and what's happening at a store geography level and the localization side. So I think the frequency is, if you're in personalization deeply for marketing, if you're really in deep and CRM is the biggest tool for that and your site, you're talking daily. I mean, you're partners, you're working together, you're on projects and work streams where you're learning and then you're applying and you're learning and you're applying. So there should be a nice loop. I mean, maybe it's weekly at the check-in kind of level, but there's going to be teams that are off working together for stretches of time. And I think that's great, that workshop model. I invite, even if the team is reporting into marketing, I am one that would invite the company planning team or the store ops team to get into our dashboard, to look at it, to see, to be able to filter and say what's happening in this region or that region by this product, by this customer that is loyalty, not loyalty, you know, to actually open up that data and say, the only thing I would caution you is let's make decisions. Let's use data for decisions, not just data for data's sake, and not get overwhelmed with it. But I would invite people to learn what we're learning about our customers and to be customer first. I'm a huge fan, obviously, of that kind of thinking. I think it's customer health at its core, and I think every part of the company should be interested in it.
And how have you approached building that tech stack, which I think is such a problem for, you know, obviously, oftentimes you're dealing with like legacy technology. Maybe it doesn't belong in the tech stack anymore if you want to do what you want to do, which is really create like this single dashboard and everybody wants like that source of truth from a data perspective. You can or not, you know, mention specific vendors that you've worked well with in the past. I don't want you to put you in an awkward position. No worries there. But I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how you've approached building out that tech stack and making those decisions about what to include and how to get the right technology put together.
I've seen some processes work. If you've got, you know, your IT team is going to be heavily involved in that. You want them to really be looking at how we're agreeing to things and what we're opening ourselves up to or not up to, and protection of data and all that good stuff. So there's a distinctive role and partnership there, of course. I think when it comes to the tech stack, what I commonly find is that you're sitting, maybe you're talking with your email team and they're simply saying, well, our platform X is not really geared for personalization of this, and that's what we really want to do. And you're stuck with a piece of technology that doesn't work, and you start to add and build and add and build. So I think it's trying to think as long-term as possible, look at other companies and see what other companies are doing, even if that's not what you're doing yet, but knowing that maybe where you're headed, you've got to have a sense of where you're headed when you're making tech decisions. You've got to have a sense of how sophisticated a company is to plug and play versus everything's bespoke, because down the road, that can become a headache if everything is bespoke. And then you're like, great, now we've got to literally build it from the ground up versus opportunity to plug and play. So there's some great players out there that allow for that flexibility or have really great reputations for working with other plugins, if you will. So I think it's hard. It's got to have a little bit of foreshadowing of what you expect your tech stack to do, but you rely on, I have relied, of course, on, you know, our IT partners, our CTO partners, and our data science team gets in the middle of it and helps us look at what we want to achieve. And is that traceable, tractable? So it's a great question. I think everybody I've ever encountered has got one vendor that they're like, oh, we added this 2 years ago. It's just not doing what we need to be done. So you got to maybe have a little foreshadowing where you can.
Yeah, be able to make the trade-off decisions, what's best for the future. And obviously, sort of diving into another area, generative AI is another emerging tech discipline that's already had a massive impact on our industry in a very short time. So thinking forward about something like generative AI. I would love your opinion, being the person that you are with the brain that you have. Where do you see the biggest near-term opportunities for Gen AI in marketing?
Yeah, I've seen some of the good, the bad, and the ugly just in training. So I happened to attend Berkeley Executive Education on Artificial Intelligence last year. So I did an 8-week course on that. And we were already applying a lot of machine learning into our data science world. So there was the idea of descriptive, prescriptive, predictive metrics we were already playing with. When it comes to true marketing forms of it, when you think about using AI to do anything from picking your subject line to creating search capabilities on your website and some other things that can be done, I think they're interesting, but there are pitfalls. There is a tone of voice that can be left. All those micro stories I talked about, AI doesn't know about them. AI can't invent them unless you tell it to. And even then, it may get it wrong. Because I went through the class, I know there are times where AI, it can get it wrong. The data isn't right. The facts are not right, or they're made up. That's scary. You don't want to put something like that in front of your customer. So I'm a tread lightly in the form of micro storytelling and education. You got to own that. You got to know what you're talking about. You've got to be the voice to your customer and not have anybody else be that voice for you. I think AI can be interesting in what's going to make somebody open this email? What's a great way to narrate something? What's a better script of this or that? But I think you've got to, the customer value prop cannot be AI'd. You cannot leave it up to a machine to talk to your customers. I think you can let machine learning tell you a lot about your customers, but I tread lightly on using it as a marketing voice.
Right. So not creating content from scratch, but maybe focusing on optimization, on how you can scale, on suggesting alternative ways of thinking about X, Y, or Z, but you're in control. You're steering it as to, here's what I potentially want you to explore for me, not expecting it to make the executive decision for you, which makes perfect sense. I mean, it's a language model, right? So it's really just predicting how to put words together at the end of the day, like not a replacement for a CMO. Yeah.
I mean, there is really a lot. You have to really get to know what's safe, right? For pet safety. That's a huge aspect of our business in that world. And you cannot let an AI model talk about safety with pet owners. There's so much emotion embedded in that. It's just like with kids, you do not want to leave it up to an AI model to write your emails for you and get it wrong, or just not have the same sentiment that you would want it to come from a team member. And ultimately it is, if it's being written by a human, and there's some love as brain bonding, right? And AI just can't bond with the machine.
Absolutely. I love that. I feel like we could keep chatting about this all day, but I do want to close this out with a few speed round questions if you're game.
Okay.
So good. So how this works, there's no right answers. I'm going to ask you a few questions. Just tell me what immediately comes to mind so that we can kind of get some insight into how your brain works. So first question, as a marketer, what keeps you up at night?
Acquisition of customers and how to keep that on the table as an investment.
Constantly have to be thinking about new ways to keep that going. What keeps you going?
Creating paths unknown. So walking a path that's never been walked before, sticking your neck out there and saying, hey, I think there's some intuition here. I think we should test and learn. We got to try it. So I really like navigating the unknown. I'm very comfortable with that as a marketer.
I love that. What marketing term do you love?
It's not pretty, but I love transformation. It's beautiful to transform an unhealthy customer to a healthy one. It's beautiful to transform a company into modern thinking. It's transformation of the customer value prop when you're evolving as a company and really thinking about how customers are using you and let them tell you how they're using you.
Love that. Now, on the flip side, what marketing term do you hate?
Well, we tried that.
Oh, so good. Yeah. I think that tracks with everything that you've already said. This is more of the random question. What emoji do you think best describes the current state of marketing?
Rocket ship. I'm positive. I've got to be positive. The rocket ship. We don't know where it's going. It's going. I think it's get on the rocket ship.
But it's going to be an upward trajectory, right?
We're going to be moving fast and furious.
Yep. And the age-old debate, quality or quantity?
Oh, I'm going to throw a wrench. And I've learned this from someone. I have to give it credit. It was that gap. It's quality of quantity or quantity of quality. If you could think of it both ways, but it's quantity of quality, not just quantity. So you got to find the quality in it.
I love it. Tricia, thank you so much for coming on, sharing your experience with us today. And hopefully we'll have you back down the line and we can reconnect on some of the topics that we just got to skim the surface on here today. But thank you so much.
Okay. Well, thank you. It was great.
Thanks for listening to Content Disrupted, brought to you by Skyward. Stay up to date on the latest ideas and insights in brand building and content marketing by visiting our website at skyward.com. Join us for our next episode, where we'll continue to challenge marketing norms and inspire you with fresh strategies for growing business through brand storytelling. See you there.